Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and we have an awesome, awesome show for you today with our guest, Joel Drucker. Joel is an accomplished tennis journalist. He is a former junior player. He played, at a relatively high level growing up in Southern California. He played high school tennis. And he has gone on to stay involved in the tennis industry as a journalist, as a pretty accomplished rec player as well. And he has some amazing insights to share with us today on being tennis parents, on what we can do to help our juniors navigate through the system, navigate through college, and you know, even possibly into the pros. But I'm really excited to bring Joel on. Just a little background, it's really funny. I first met Joel 6 years ago at the U.S. Open. It was my very first time to visit the U.S. Open, and I happened to be having lunch in the Players Lounge, courtesy of a friend, and Joel was at the table, and we started chatting, and it turns out that Joel and my husband went to junior high school together in West L.A., a million years ago, and it's just such a funny connection to meet someone like that and have that family connection, you know, pulling you together. So I'm really excited to have Joel on. Before I bring him on the air, though, I want to play a quick commercial, pay our bills for the week, and when we come back, Joel Drucker.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Welcome back to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and as I mentioned before, we have a great show for you today with our guest, Joel Drucker. If you are listening and would like to call in with questions for Joel or comments on anything we're discussing, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 714-583-6853. Again, that's 714-583-6853. Without further ado, I would like to welcome Joel Drucker to Parenting Aces. Joel, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on, Lisa.
I'm so excited to hear your insights. I mean, you and I have chatted a little bit about your thoughts, and you definitely have some very strong opinions on what we're doing well and what we could do better. But before we jump into that, I want to just ask you about your own experiences playing junior tennis. What are your best memories of your years coming up through the juniors?
Well, coming up means for me, I was happy in Southern California to win two rounds in the junior tournament. So that was coming up. I think the thing I enjoyed most, and this relates to what my parents' role in my tennis, I enjoyed that it was something I had pretty much to myself. My parents, they weren't that into the whole tennis thing. I mean, they paid for me to have lessons for about a year and a half, and I went to tennis camp when I was in my teens, but it wasn't a high-powered academy. And you know, they would buy me rackets at various times. But really, it was my deal to tennis. And so I think the fact that I owned it myself was really important. I mean, so my parents would say, go look at the draw and find someone who's playing the tournament and call them and see if you could get a ride. And then I'd figure out a way to get a ride back. And until I started driving myself, that's how I often got to and from tournaments. So in a way, what I think I liked most about tennis is my thing and mine alone, that I got to have my ownership of tennis. Now, I'll grant you, that probably cost me results, whatever that means, and outcome, you know, different kind of outcomes. So I never played the national juniors, and I wasn't in those days, they only ranked so many kids, so I wasn't a ranked junior, which was a meaningful thing then. It was very meaningful if you were a ranked junior as opposed to just one who played. So I think I liked playing. I liked competing. I liked, you know, growing up in Southern California in the 70s, there were a zillion ways to compete at tennis, both through tournaments, through, let's say, more park tournaments, through some league things I played in. So I played a lot. The year I turned 16, I think I played about 27 tournaments.
Wow.
And that was really fun.
And do you have any bad memories of those years?
I think the bad memories come from what I used to call the 8:45 handshake. I remember often, not often, but frequently enough, driving somewhere like Fullerton or Santa Ana or Ventura, somewhere, let's say, an hour from where I was living. Driving there, arriving at 7:45, seeing that I was going to play a seed who I was almost certain to lose to, and then by 8:45, knowing I would be back in my car, and it was over. And so my weekend competitive tennis experience was over. There weren't backdraws. There weren't other kinds of events. There was doubles was sporadic. So I think that the bad memories come from those experiences. Also the experience that I've had because of aspects of my playing style, of being yelled at by people. I remember the very first tournament I played at, the guy beat me and called me a flippin' dinker and got mad at me. And it took me a long time to understand that the opponent getting mad at you for not letting them play well is a good thing. But there wasn't a lot of infrastructure for teaching that. I mean, people then had to learn that on their own.
Right. Absolutely. So given your experiences, and you said your parents were pretty hands-off, what are some things that they did well as tennis parents?
Well, I think the thing that my parents did well, they wouldn't even have thought of themselves as tennis parents. They would have thought of themselves as parents who had a kid who happened to play tennis. But I think the thing they did is that they had zero engagement with my outcome. So, for example, when I started playing tournaments in the 14s, I lost in the first round of the first 8 tournaments I played. And there was never a roadside pullover on the part of my parents to say, well, how is this going? What is it going? It's just an activity I did. Win, lose. I remember once I lost in a little after that, when I finally won a few matches, I lost in the first round of another tournament. And my dad said, oh, that guy who beat you, he's got 25 years from now, he's going to want to send you his resume. He's going to want to work for you. So it didn't matter. There was never a thought like, well, how is your tennis going? Why are you losing? What do you do? All they knew was that it was something that I enjoyed and I kept liking playing. And I wasn't thinking after I lost in the first round of, let's say, the first 3 tournaments I played, oh, no, what is going on here? Why am I losing? So I'm losing. So what? I'm playing. I think the thing they best did, let it go play, enjoy it. Good. And if you don't, then don't. That's fine. Doesn't matter. There wasn't an attachment to any of my outcomes.
And what about your process? Were they engaged in your practices or your lessons, or that was all you as well?
That was all me. I told them I wanted to have lessons, and I remember for about a year and a half, this is before I was driving, I would take a lesson at a private court in Bel Air, fairly close to where I lived. My mom would drop me off at 3:30 for the lesson. I would take the lesson from 3:30 to 4:30, and the instructor he had another lesson from 4:30 to 5:30, and I would wait for his lesson to finish, and then he would drive me home.
Wow.
So my mom would drop me off at the lesson, and that was it. I mean, it's probably for parents like yourself and the parents listening to that, it's kind of unbelievable to think of that. At the same time, though, I won't lie and tell you that I was a gung-ho junior who was, you know, college tennis then, particularly growing up in Southern California, the basic thinking was, if you're not good enough to play for a school like USC or UCLA or Stanford, well, then you're not good at all, and that's that. And so there wasn't a thought about, well, work hard and you can maybe a D3 liberal arts school or a lesser tier school or sub-zonal regional tournaments where you end up being ranked 71 in the country and you get taught and you talk to someone at Indiana. There was zero of that infrastructure really available. So it really wasn't even on the table. It was really the stone age of what that kind of thing was. There weren't databases, you know, there wasn't a whole college recruiting.net. None of that existed. Tennis was just an activity. And I was and also growing up in California then, the University of California college system was a big way that churned in a lot of kids from points of public schools like myself. Berkeley, where I went, was one of the top. They were number two in the country when I was a sophomore. I wasn't even thinking about college tennis. I didn't think about college tennis at all. And maybe if I had, I would have thought, taken a little bit more creative approach to colleges. I mean, in a way, it's kind of parallel to how people view applying for college, regardless of whether they're a tennis player or not. Like, then there was a way less thinking about colleges. People weren't taking SAT prep classes. I had a friend of mine, he was the first person I ever knew who took those SAT tutoring classes. That didn't exist. I want to say, here's a story for you. I was going to go to a tournament in San Diego 2 hours away. I was driving, and there was a girl I knew who wanted to come watch me play. And she told me on a Friday morning that she couldn't go to the tournament. And I decided, and this had to do with my own attitude towards tennis, I said, well, I guess I won't play the tennis. I think I'll take the SAT tomorrow instead. So I did that. So I went to UCLA, which is a mile from my house, and took the SAT instead of playing a junior tournament. And I didn't do any prep work for the SAT. And I hardly did. Well, granted, I regret that I didn't invest more energy into my tennis, truly. I mean, it wasn't until I was 16 or 17 that I realized, oh, I see these better players. They have a match at 8, but they're hitting at 7. They're warming up prior to the match. Wow, that might be helpful. I hadn't even thought of that, or taking extra time for things like practicing serves or playing yet more practice matches. I kind of, for a number of reasons, continually kind of sold myself short on my own tennis as a junior. But that's okay. All those things for a reason. And the great thing about it is I came out of that really loving tennis and liking to play. And so coming out through the other end of college where I didn't play college tennis, I like the game even more. And so I continue to enjoy it as a recreational player.
That's fantastic to hear. I know you have a brother. Is that your only sibling, your brother?
Yeah, I have an older brother. Uh-huh.
Okay. So was he a tennis player as well?
Yeah, we moved to Los Angeles in 1970, and my mother started playing tennis shortly thereafter. And then we all got a little involved in tennis, and my brother's 4 years older than me, and he was fairly athletic, so he started to play tennis. And I'm glad you put that on the question. It's about a sibling, because I think it really is significant in the history of tennis how you see the presence of an older sibling can kind of compel motivation. I remember covering a Davis Cup tie in 2006 where there was Roddick, who had an older brother, James Blake, who had an older brother, the Bryan brothers, who were twins, Patrick McEnroe was the captain, he of course had an older brother, and there's probably something to be said for the motivation of the younger sibling wanting to compete with the older sibling to earn their approval. So my brother and I, when I was 12 and he was 16 and he could drive, we would go play, and he would beat me, and we played a number of times. We played a lot. Yeah, we played a lot. It's probably till I was about 14 or 15, by then I could beat him, and then for whatever reason he stopped playing.
And did it affect your relationship with him when you started winning?
No, not really. They were a whole bunch of other things that affected my relationship with him that are covered in my book about Jimmy Connors that are well beyond the scope of the tennis court.
Yeah. Yeah, I read about that, but I didn't know if you wanted to touch on it. But your relationship with him is mended now, I hope?
That's fine, yeah. And then the tennis part is that, you know, that no, he didn't mind that I was able to beat him tennis. Maybe he minded because he may have stopped playing, so that's how he minded, but no, it's fine. I was more engaged with tennis than he was. I think tennis was something he had been involved in some other sports. He played basketball and he played on the tennis team in high school, but he wasn't he came to it. I think it's different. It's every year in tennis is a little different, and him coming to it at 16 is a little different than me coming to it at 12. As you know,
sure.
As a tennis parent, that's a significant difference in years.
Sure, sure.
So I was able to do some work on my game when I was 13 and 14 that he hadn't done. And so he's 16, 17. And again, in that era of L.A., there were so many good players that I think there wasn't a lot of thought on, well, just be the best player you can be. I think the thought was, well, if you're not a big-time player, you're not good anyway. So don't even bother.
Interesting. All right. So I have to ask you, you've been around hundreds, maybe thousands, of juniors and professional players in your work as a journalist. What are some of the biggest mistakes you've seen parents make in terms of being a tennis parent?
The biggest thing I look for in the parents that I worry about is when I hear the parent be attached to outcome, to results, to rankings, to all the rewards that constitute the tennis experience. And when they talk about that kind of stuff, those to me are the red flags. In a way, I see a lot of the pros, in a way they're the ones they got the goodies, so in a way seeing the parents at that phase is kind of less useful than seeing the parents along the path. And so I see things, when I hear the parents say, we are going to play a tournament, that to me is a big red flag. The parent is not playing the tournament. The child is playing the tournament. So they said, we're going to play Savannah. We're going to play the Nationals. No, we're not. Or when I hear the parent talk about the potential rewards of what can come from the tennis, whether it's the college scholarship or rankings or free lists or anything like that, those to me are the big mistakes. I mean, basically when a parent says, hey, you can get a scholarship for this, they're basically turning their kid into a commodity, into a professional, into a source of revenue. When I wrote a good English paper, my mother didn't say, wow, he could get a scholarship. That would have made me about as likely to write another English paper as I would have wanted to run for the King of Spain. I mean, that's the big problem I find with parents. They get attached to the outcome, and then as a result, the tennis becomes based on rewards and things like that rather than the process. I mean, a friend of mine was talking about his son who was playing. He says, yeah, he's working hard, and I think he might get there. And I go, get where? Get where? What are you talking about? Why can't he just be here? Let him just be here. And that's what I find is the big mistake, is parents who are looking at outcomes rather than processes.
Interesting. There's been a lot written lately about that, about differentiating between the process and the outcome. And, you know, I do think as parents, we put a lot of focus on wins and losses because it's something concrete we can put our finger on, as opposed to a process which is constantly changing and,
yep.
You know, which we have to just step back and trust. And you know, I can't speak for anybody but myself, but I'm so type A, it's really difficult to step back and trust. And, you know, we're going to get into that in a minute because I know you have some thoughts about that as well. But if you were giving advice to a parent who wants to help his or her junior player achieve the highest potential, whatever that means, what would that be? I mean, what would you say to that parent?
Great. Well, first I would say, don't look at it as achieving. Don't look at it as enjoying. Because even achieving makes it sound like there's a spot the child can get to. And that's not really the point, the object of the engagement. the object of the engagement. The point is to enjoy the game for it being the game, to certainly compete. And, of course, it's more fun to win than to lose. We all know that. That's okay. But to let them relish what learning is. I mean, again, use a parallel discipline. If this were literature or history, a topic that a kid would like studying when he was 11 years old, the parent wouldn't want to know how they could achieve their best potential as a student, as a writer, as a thinker. They would just say, how can he continue to immerse and engage? And I guess the thing I would say to the parent is, let them have the kid have the broadest exposure possible to what all the letters of the tennis alphabet. And the biggest lesson, the biggest thing of all, is for the child to learn to be self-reliant. I think that's one of the greatest things that tennis can teach us. So, for example, when I play with juniors, I mean, I'll play with an 11-year-old or a 12-year-old. The first time they want to play, the parent will call me and ask if I can play with their child, and that's fine. From then on, I say to the parent, I say, if your child wants to call me to play, I will play him, but I will not take a phone call from a parent on the second time. I want the child to initiate the phone call.
Interesting.
That's a big thing. I want the child to learn how to make a phone call, to call an adult, to say, hi, let's play on Tuesday. And it's funny, and there's a kid who at my club who got pretty good, and he was 12 or 13, and he hadn't done it. I hit with him when he was 11, and the father said to me, well, he's only recently started making phone calls. And I said, phone calls? That's the easy part. I got the phone call down when I was 10. The hard part is the forehand. I'm 50 years old. I'm still working on the forehand. He's got the forehand. That's the hard part.
That's funny.
So I think the self-reliance and letting them be exposed to many aspects of the game, which a lot of times, see, the parent may not know, but a child by the time he's 11 or 12 might have an awareness of what goes on the tennis court beyond what the parent even knows. The parent might have played some. The parent might have been a good player to some degree. Many are not. Many taught themselves the game, and they could teach their child technique. But to understand what goes on in match play, that requires some experience. And you got to let the kid have that too, and let the kid work through that, and let the kid problem solve and learn different things. I mean, learn how to volley, learn how to come to net, learn how to serve and volley, broaden their tactical array. That's the biggest problem, I think, in our young kids as players, is that they learn the game, they learn a very narrow way to play tennis.
Interesting. All right, we have a caller. Let me just see if they're just listening to the show, if they have a question. I have a caller, area code 561451. Are you there?
Yeah, hi. How are you? It's Sandy Hollett.
Hey,
I'm listening to Joel, who's a colleague, and everything's making such sense. I thought I'd call in and tell him. He sounds very rational. I'm very pleased to hear.
Well, Sandy, long-time listener, first-time caller?
First-time caller, yes,
long-time
I am.
Long-time listener, first-time caller?
Yes.
Any special requests?
Oh, yes. Do you do Bruce Springsteen? No.
Yeah, I can do the parent thing, Born to Run.
Yeah, there you go. I think a key point Joe is making is that your child doesn't have to be a tennis player unless they want to be a tennis player. You know, your child doesn't have to be a piano virtuoso unless they want to be. And if you find an outlet for your kid that they enjoy and that they want to pursue, it's great. But too often I feel like a parent is pursuing something for their kid because they want to live vicariously through that child, and that's just not a healthy environment.
Absolutely. And I know, Sandy, you've got some pretty strong feelings. For those of you who haven't listened to it yet, I have a great interview with Sandy that we did during the U.S. Open on ParentingAces.com, so please take a listen to it. But, Sandy, you have similar experience to Joel in terms of being in the journalist world and being around these players as they come up through juniors and gone through college and gone into the pros, and you've seen a lot in terms of parents doing stuff well and parents doing stuff really sucky. And, you know, if you would like to add to what Joel has shared with us, we'd love to hear from you.
Well, I think all his points were so valid, and I think he really covered it, but I do think the point is, I mean, what he mentioned about when the parents start saying, we're doing this and we're doing that, it's not, and that's where the, you know, living through the kid vicarious, I often find that the parent was not or is not satisfied with who they became, so they want to... they want the child to succeed in where they felt like they didn't succeed. And I always find it so much better when a kid is self-motivated. And when Joel said about the phone call, I recall I always felt Andy Roddick loved the sport because while his parents gave him tennis, you know, his older brother wanted to dive and everything. It wasn't like they felt like they were trying to achieve something. They just wanted to help Andy achieve what he wanted. And I never forget calling him to do an interview when he first, when he won the Australian Open. And he called me, you know, he called me back. He made the arrangements for me to meet him at his school. And I'm like thinking to myself, okay, you know, is he really going to remember this? I said, oh, I'll call you on Monday to remind you about our appointment on Tuesday. He goes, no, I'll tell the secretary at school that you're coming and everything will be fine. And I was a little bit, you know, worried. Oh, will he remember? We're talking about 6 days away and everything. But I drove up to the school and the secretary had all the information and said, I'll get Andy to come up and talk to you. So I think when a kid's that responsible and he wants it, that's when it's a healthy environment.
That's a great story. I love that.
Yeah, no, he was very self-motivated. I think his parents did everything they could, and fortunately for him, they could afford to do everything they could to facilitate him becoming who he wanted to become. And I think they also had, you know, realistic, as did the Macros. I think they looked at John and they said he was going to college. It was a different era. But after a year, they said it was fine for him to move on. But like Patrick, they looked at him and they said, you're going to college for 4 years because you're not John, so you're going to have a fallback. And I never forget seeing him at Stratton Mountain Tournament very soon after he graduated from Stanford, and he was waiting to play doubles, and he was studying. I go, what are you doing? He goes, oh, I'm studying for the law boards because my parents said I should take it just in case this doesn't work out.
Plan B is a good thing.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm going to leave you back to Joel, but I just wanted to call in.
Thanks, Sandy.
Thanks, Sandy. Good
to hear from you. And Joel, yep. Have another caller on the line, too. I'm going to just check in. We have a caller from area code 949-885. Are you there?
Yes, I am. It's Chris Lewis calling.
Oh, hey, my. Wimbledon time. I'm on the phone with a Wimbledon finalist. Uh-oh.
Joel and Lisa, Joel, I'm thoroughly enjoying the interview and just want to congratulate you for the spectacularly wise advice that you're giving to parents out there. I think you're comment about developing self-reliance is the single most important thing a parent can do for a child in his tennis upbringing or her tennis upbringing.
Thanks. I'm glad you got that, Chris. So that's fun. I think that's the great lesson. That's what we all want in life is a form of self-reliance, right?
I think it is, and I think, you know, it's the whole point of education. Whatever the discipline is, whether it be tennis or academics, it's getting a child to actually think for himself and to have that skill on a tennis court. Well, you know, what better skill is there? I've got a question for you, Joel.
Fire away.
In motivation, what motivates a young player? Is it the desire to become the best he or she can be, or is it to win? And I think the two complement one another, but I think there's a primary and there's a secondary motivation that is inherent in the way most people approach the game. You wrote a book, Jimmy Connors Saved My Life, which was an absolutely wonderful book, by the way. What do you think Jimmy's primary motivation was in that context? Was it to be the best he could be, or do you think it was to beat opponents? And then contrast that with somebody like, say, an Ivan Lendl or a Mats Wilander or a Bjorn Borg. What are your thoughts
on
that?
That's a great question, Chris, and I think, you know, Connors and the American milieu is the one I know best, and I have to admit, and I know this gets to the thing that Lisa and I, when we were talking about, let's say, me playing my older brother, for all my talk about process, I think those concepts are a little hard for a young person to grasp process and outcome, and I think at a certain point there's something rather primal about tennis, which is like whether it's the best friend you know, the friend you start playing with or the sibling. It's like, I want to beat that person. It's that, it's kind of that, it can be that visceral immediately. You know, I haven't spoken with, I haven't studied Borg or Wielander the way I studied Connors, but I know from, in tennis, I think there's something as simple as like, you know, if you start off playing with a mate or a friend or a sibling, it's like, wait, they're beating me. I don't like that. How do I beat them? Like, I remember when I was 12, I had a friend who had a pretty good forehand, and I hadn't learned how to serve properly, and then I'm left-handed, and then I taught myself a spin serve so I could serve to his backhand, and then I could beat him. And I think in the short term, it's initially, I just want to win against some of these other people. You know, I think it's a little hard. I think it's a little hard for a 8-year-old or an 11-year-old to think, this is a lifelong craft and a process, and I'm going to learn it. However, I think competition is really healthy in a sports environment. I think it's great. I think it's great. I think there's a lot of great things that come from it. So I think the motivation is kind of very visceral and close. I mean, how could a Mats Wielander or even a Jimmy Connors at the age of 10 see that it was going to take them to a life? You know, that heart at heart, Wielander at 10 was no different from me at 10. You know, they're just a kid hitting a ball. I don't know. What do you think, Chris?
Well, I think I look at the relationship, and you outlined this in your book, was the relationship between Jimmy and his mom. And I think that the environment in which Jimmy grew up in was a major factor in his formative years when he was 10 or 11. And I think, you know, obviously that shaped him as a player. My personal view is, here's an interesting story, is that I worked with Ivan Lendl for 3 years, and one of the first questions I asked Ivan was, what is your primary motivation? Is it to be the best you can be, or is it to beat other players, to be number one? And he said, oh, that's simple. He said, it's to be the absolute best I can be, and if I am, I will be number one. And he said,
well,
it was such
great
confidence. And he was like that. I know that when he was 16 and 17. Whereas I think Jimmy, I think it was instilled in him from a very young age that it was Jimmy against the world.
Right.
And therefore, his primary motivation was to beat other players. So in a sense, I think he did have a very clear idea of what motivated when he was younger. You would know much more about that than me. However, I do find it a fascinating question because I like looking at personalities of young players and then shaping a game that fits with those personalities. And I think Jimmy's game was a perfect reflection of a street fighting personality, whereas Bjorn's was also a perfect reflection of his type of personality, both very different.
Well, how do you think Borg went about building his? I mean, Borg had it was an athletic thing from another sport that he loved, from the hockey. And he originated a style that no one had seen before, right?
Absolutely. He pioneered different grips and a heavier topspin, and in that sense, he was a pioneer. And I think that my guess, an educated guess, would be given, you know, his he comes from Sweden, which has a very different culture from the American. And I think he was an extraordinary individualist who grew up in a collectivist culture.
Right.
And I think it was his outlet, in the same way that a lot of the Eastern Europeans escaped communism because tennis was the vehicle that gave them that escape. They hated the environment, and tennis, an individualistic sport, was something that they loved and gravitated towards and also saw it as a means of escaping what was a claustrophobic environment.
That collectivist culture of Sweden, and I could tell that whenever I talked to Wielander, was it kind of mutes the whole competitive thing. You know, our country is different about that, and so tennis in some ways kind of exacerbates that whole American and individuals and how we go about pursuing things and this kind of craven approach, whereas the collectivist cultures are a little bit more nurturing. And, you know, it's no big deal if you don't happen to be great. You know, Mats Wielander was going to be Mats Wielander, whoever he became. It wasn't this whole, it appeared to be not this do-or-die thing to the tennis. He seemed to play because he enjoyed it, you know?
Absolutely, and I would agree with that. I think there's a distinction between the way the Europeans grow up. I think there's more camaraderie. I think it's more of a team approach, and I'm not necessarily saying it's a better approach. I'm just making the contrast here between the American way of doing things and the European way of doing things. I'm actually very much pro-individualist, so I admire the way America has achieved its success in virtually every sport, including tennis, until recently, that is. So I'm not taking sides one way or the other. I'm just thinking that with Mats and Bjorn, there was probably more interaction amongst their peers when it came to practices, things like that, whereas in the U.S., it's done on a more individualistic basis. And it's very interesting, as a foreigner myself, observing the contrast between the two approaches.
Oh, and the other, see, I get the idea in the countries like Sweden or Australia, those players, they got on with one another, and they happened to compete against each other. In America, I mean, I remember this in Southern California, I didn't feel I had the right to talk to certain other juniors. You know, that
Go ahead.
There was this whole, and some of them are more that way than others. I mean, some of them were gracious and they just happened to win a tennis match, and others there's an attitude, well, I beat you 1-1 in a match, so I'm a better person than you too. I mean, you played plenty of players from Southern California like Elliot Telcher or Danny Saltz or Robert Vanthoff. I mean, these were fine enough players, but I don't know, just an interesting dynamic, you know?
And what it reminds me of, and I don't want to monopolize time here, but first of all, I want to preface any comments I make here with saying that there are many Southern Californians whom I really liked. So this is not an indictment on any of those players, and I'm not going to mention any names, but I grew up in an era where there was actually, I saw the culture clash between the Australian way of doing things, and you're very familiar with the Australian greats like Newcomb and Laver and Roach and Rosewell, I mean, just legends of the game. And then what was more of an American approach, and you saw it in the ethics. For example, when Australians would play each other or anybody else, they would give calls away. They were very, very conscious of the other person at the other end of the court. There was an immense respect for an opponent. I think what was ushered in the sort of mid to late 70s was more of the American college culture, where you had a lot of the American college kids coming in off the colleges onto the tour, out of the colleges, and the ethic was more, if you can get away with it, then it's okay. And there was a subsequent cultural clash, and it was interesting being caught right in the middle of that as a New Zealander and actually playing people and trying to figure out what course to take yourself, because you would be playing guys who would try and get away with anything. And I would treat those players in a completely different context than if I were playing an Australian player who was prepared to give me a call that he thought was in, that I hit, that sort of thing.
That's so interesting to talk about that and the difference in the mindset and kind of win at all costs mentality. Because we've talked a lot on this show about cheating among juniors and how it's become so rampant, and you know, different strategies that kids need to employ and why, you know, maybe one thing works better than another. But interesting to hear from you guys that this was really a cultural difference. 40 years ago.
Absolutely, and it's interesting watching, Lisa, the culture evolve. I'm in Southern California now, so I'm very familiar with Southern California junior tennis. And just contrasting that with the sort of tournament environment I grew up in, and seeing how things have evolved. And, you know, it's a hugely important subject, is how do parents actually deal with kids who have been the victim, or sons and daughters who have been the victims of cheating. You know, it's a major issue, and it applies in a much wider context than just sport, because it is those principles that the parent teaches the child that are then applied in every sphere of life.
Sure. When you come on the show, Chris, we're going to talk about that.
I'll look forward to it, and I'll leave you guys to get on with it so I can enjoy listening to more of you and Joel.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks.
Good stuff.
Thanks for calling in.
Good stuff. Thanks, Chris.
Bye.
So, Joel, you opened up something that I want to kind of explore a little further, and that was Jimmy Connors' relationship with his mom and her involvement in his development as a tennis player, because we started the show talking about how your parents were one of the things they did so well is that they left you to your tennis. Jimmy Connors' mom was the complete opposite of that. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on, you know, does it take that type of strong parental involvement for a child to reach the highest levels of our sport? Or can it be
a lot more? It takes way more parental involvement than mine for the person to be the more quality tennis experience and to become a pro. There's no pro whose parents were involved, even to the point. I mean, I look at the McEnroe family, and the McEnroe family was, while in some degree laissez-faire, was certainly not laissez-faire when it came to making sure that John and Patrick had coaching, were driven and flown to tournaments, had all sorts of resources given to them. So, even the very basic thing of bringing the child to tournaments and getting the child exposed to teaching and coaching, that absolutely takes place. So that's...
And even now, you know, at the highest levels of junior competition, we're seeing that. I mean, you know, kids are flying hither and yon
right.
to compete. And, you know, unless you have ungodly amounts of money, it's rare to find a child who's traveling solely with buddies or with a coach. I mean, now the parents are omnipresent. So,
well, I guess, I really am going to stress, in order to continue to enjoy the game, not in order to achieve, because what comes out to the other end, Chris had a great experience. Chris was a top 20 player Chris and his peers and all those players got the goodies, got the desired outcomes. But that's not the world we're trying to live in. And all the other ones, what I want to avoid are kids who do all this stuff when they're 15, 16, 17, then they end up going to college. And then when they're 24, they said, enough of tennis. I did it. That was a thing my parents and I did together when I was 16 because my parents were so gung-ho on me doing it. And I don't know if I like it or not. So I guess I don't. And it's boring because I don't even know how to volley. Mm-hmm. And I stop. And they're 24 years old and they don't play anymore. And once upon a time, they were a little tennis protege. See, so I think it's really important for all parents to divorce themselves of it being about achieving. It should be about enjoying. My parents didn't like the fact that I did well in English classes so I could eventually be a writer. That wasn't the point. The point was that I liked reading, and the point was that I liked writing, period. You know?
Right. But what if you have a child who, by virtue of talent and hard work and desire, is winning?
That's good. Then let it go where it should go. It'll go where the game will take him where it's meant to take him. It'll take him where it's meant to take him. So let him... Right, so he's getting good results in the section and playing some regionals and nationals. It's great. Keep doing it. But then what? You mean to get better coaching, to get better as a player?
Well, that and also, you know, at what point as a parent do you say, okay, you know, my kid is asking to go to Kalamazoo. My kid is asking to go to South America to play ITFs in the summer.
Well, Kalamazoo asks him more than he asks Kalamazoo, isn't that right?
Wait, say that again?
Kalamazoo asks him more than he asks Kalamazoo. In other words, he needs to be of a certain ranking level to get into a tournament like that, correct?
Correct. However, he might need to set that as a goal and then work hard to set that goal. Right? So, you know, again, as the parent, it's very difficult to know where to draw the line, to say...
Then it's simple. Then you're right. Then the kid, like if the kid is 14 and says, you know what, 2 years from now I want to play the National 16 at Kalamazoo, then I think it's up to the kid with maybe input from the instructor or coach or whoever to try to figure out, how do we do that? And what needs to be given up in order to do that? That's fine.
So,
you're right. I think the parent can be in the middle of that for sure. But the parent isn't orchestrating that. The parent will help support that. Don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, yes. But I think there's that triangle and that leads us into kind of the next area that I want to talk to you about, which is the relationship between the parent, the coach, and the player.
Fantastic relationship. Fantastic. That's the strike zone.
Well, yeah, but how do you balance it? And as the parent, you and I were talking before we went on air about the challenge of the coach coaches, in at least in the U.S., a lot of the ones that I've talked to, you know, they hate us tennis parents. They bash us in these forums on Facebook and wherever else. I mean, it's disheartening to read some of this. And, you know, your response is, well, they have reason to feel that way because a lot of parents are really overstepping their bounds and hovering and being involved where they have no business being involved. The flip side of that is, as parents, how do we, what questions do we ask, what research do we do to feel comfortable that the coach we've entrusted our child to is actually the best person for the job?
That's a fantastic question, and that's a real trial and error process, and that's a real, I think the key thing to always ask is this coach or instructor, and I'm reluctant to call a lot of instructors coaches. A coach, I wonder how many, a coach watches their player play matches. A coach does something other than feed balls and do game, you know what I mean? A coach should watch you play a match. That's what coaches should do. And if they're not doing that, then they're instructing, and that's okay too. That's okay too. But I guess the question for the parent to ask, how is this teacher helping my child become a better tennis player? And that's a process-based thing. What things are they doing? What skills have they identified in my child? What, and Chris is fantastic at this, what are they doing to help my child build a game, build a real way of how to play and how to address the game that's something other than just stroke production and technique? Because if the child is, let's say, 14 or 15 years old and good enough to start contemplating things like, what do I got to do to get to Kalamazoo? They probably have a pretty good read on how to hit the ball. So they're a little bit more than just a beginner, fresher. You know, they've competed some. So now the question is, how is this coach helping my child become a better tennis player? How are they exposed? Think of them no differently than a teacher of physics or social studies or math. How are they helping broaden my child's tennis education? And are they giving them homework? It's no different than a teacher and anything else. Are they giving them homework? Are there lesson plans? Are there ideas? You know.
And if there aren't, then what?
Then it's not. Then maybe it's not the right fit. Then maybe you have the roadside pullover with the coach and say, "I'm a little confused. What are we really doing here in this process?" And maybe the child, and ideally the child should drive it too. You know, maybe the parent talks to the child and says, What's going on in your lesson? Sometimes the parent comes, sometimes the parent can't come. I think that I'm kind of neutral about that. I've talked to coaches who are fine when the parent comes. I've talked to coaches who don't like when the parent comes. Ideally, I think the parent, I'd like to think the parent shouldn't, but I kind of get why they would like to.
Okay.
But, you know, again, and asking yourself, how is my child becoming, learning the game and becoming more self-reliant? Because the kid is the one who should be driving this education.
Right,
like,
right.
The kid is the one. I mean, all right, you're a tennis mom. You're around tennis parents. When kids arrange their practice matches, how do they do that? Do they make the phone calls?
Well, it depends on the age of the child, certainly.
13 and up.
Yeah, well, they should be, for sure.
Are they?
They should be making arrangements. There aren't a lot of practice matches, to be honest.
Well, see, that's the big thing at the core of it, because nothing simulates the game more than playing the game. And all the workouts and all the techniques, I mean, that's composition. That's not literature. You know, that's not the game. The game is playing those practice sets, because that comes closest to playing practice sets and practice matches, and that's what you're doing when you want to get to Kalamazoo. There isn't, as the ex-pro Trey Waalke said to once, there isn't a national drilling competition, you know?
Well, one of the things that you talked about a little earlier was how there was kind of that pecking order and how there were certain players that didn't speak to you because they had beaten you 1-1 or whatever.
Didn't feel I could talk to them. That was even more strange, is that I didn't feel I could talk to them. You know what I mean? Right.
So, but what I see a lot is there's a lot of keeping kids separate. You know, you can't play a practice match with your buddy Joe, who you've played 4 times in competition, because he may learn something about your game in practice that will allow him to beat you the next time you play a real match in a tournament. And so these practice matches, at least where I am in the Atlanta area, they don't happen as often as I would like, and certainly not as often as they happened for me coming up through the juniors. So I think that's an inherent problem, and I can't speak for anywhere else because I don't know what other people's experiences are that way.
Right.
But here I can tell you it's a problem, and even when my son has, you know, picked up the phone and called six different guys to try and schedule a practice match, it's really hard to make that happen.
That's unfortunate. That has to change somehow. And at the same time, it should be there are adults, there are people that, I mean, you know, aspiring juniors should be playing, what, three or four practice matches a week at least. I mean,
and not necessarily just against other juniors, correct?
Well, against people, you know, if they can't, if they can't find other juniors, then they, yeah, against all sorts of, you know, you want to be better, you got to beat everybody.
Right.
Go,
right.
You know, it's like Wayne Bryant says, who needs to go to an academy? Go beat everyone on your block 6-0, and if you
right.
can't beat them 6-0, and then beat them playing another way 6-0. Beat them
mm-hmm.
for the baseline 6-0. Beat them serving and volleying 6-0.
True.
You know, beat them coming in on your return.
Right.
You know, play
right.
doubles with the older hacks at the club and serve and volley. Serve and volley with only one serve. Come in on your return. Play the ad court. Play the deuce court. That's why I think some of these mini academies, I think, are kind of, they're just basically monetized, ways of monetized practice matches. You know, guys who charge like what, $35 or $50 a day for the kid to get practice matches. It's like what, organized tennis play dates, right?
Right. That's true. All right, we have another caller on the line. Let me pull him on. Area code 786-273. Are you there? 786-273. Yep, they may be just listening. All right, I'll put them back on hold. And we have another caller from 678-755. Are you there?
Hey, Lisa, it's Tim Seals. How are you?
Hey, Tim, how are you?
Hey, I'm just doing great. Just came off the court and was catching the show, and you guys were hitting a couple topics that, you know, I wanted to chime in on if I could and get you guys' reaction to. You were talking about the, you know, with regards to the parents' involvement, and I think what has happened is, you know, as a parent, you know, you're so used to micromanaging your child's lives that once you get involved in tennis and you turn your kid over to a coach, you have to be able to give away some of that control as a parent. And then what happens is the parents themselves, if they haven't been before, they slowly get a little bit educated about the tennis process. And they're the ones that are sitting there more often than the coaches, unfortunately, watching the matches at the tournaments week in and week out, talking to other parents who are equally mildly educated about tennis. And it's amazing to me. I'll be at a tournament. I just got back from one this weekend out of state. And you'll hear the parents talking, and I'm sitting there listening to the parents talking back and forth about the game. And I'm like, truly, these people have very little idea of actually what's going on out there. But they're exchanging this disinformation between each other. And so what happens is the parents then start becoming involved in trying to coach the kid off the court after the lesson, after the practice, whether it's in the car coming back from the match or after the practice, or whether they're sitting there watching the U.S. Open on TV. And so I think what's happening is the parents are trying – you can't go and get a coach and say, here, I entrust my kid's game to you, and then turn around and try to keep micromanaging and picking at the game after the kid leaves the court. So I think for the big thing for the parents is they really need to separate themselves as parents from the coaching process. Of course, unless they have a lot of expertise in the field and, you know, and can manage it. But it's not easy, you know, going between trying to be a parent and trying to be a assistant coach to the coach, if you know what I mean.
I couldn't agree with you more, Tim. I think the parent who doesn't understand the game in a lot of ways can create a lot of bad language. You know, the parent, oh, he lost to a pusher, or he wasn't giving anything to hit. And what is the parent, many parents, they don't know how the game is played. They don't understand the game tactically or strategically. They see balls being hit. They watch the lessons where the kid strikes a lot of balls, but they don't know, they don't understand the problem solving, what goes on in a match. It takes a lot of experience and years to understand the ebb and flow of a match. In a way, that kid, that's his match. Let him have his match. Let him. So maybe a good pointer is for parents, be a parent, not an, yeah, an assistant coach. That's a bad thing, to be an assistant coach. That's generally
yeah,
a bad
agree.
Thing.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, I've had this right now with some of the younger kids that I have that have now been in my system for a couple of years and are starting to assert themselves. And as they assert themselves, the parents are starting to assert themselves more. So it's a very fine line between stepping in for, you know, as a coach and saying, gosh, you know, you really need to back off your kid and, you know, leave the coaching to the coaches and, you know, try to keep your opinions more to the positive side and, you know, keep the kid excited about playing the game and let the coaches be the bad guys when you need to be a bad guy on the court with the corrections and whatnot. So I'm going to run and let you guys finish up your show. Thanks a lot, and have a great day, okay?
Thanks for calling in, Tim.
Oh, yeah, anytime. Thank you.
So, Joel, this all, you know, kind of begs the question of when do we, as parents, step in and, you know, how do we kind of initiate the conversation with the coach to say, you know, can you explain to me what the steps are that you're going to take with my child, and can you let me know when it's appropriate for me to interject my thoughts and when you want me to stay out of things? I think one of the issues from the parent side, and again, I'm just speaking from my personal experience, is that a lot of times the coaches are not clearly communicating what our role as the parent is supposed to look like. And so,
well, they don't know. You're right, because they're not sure, and they're a little too. It's almost like the parents say, "Look, tell you what, I'm going to give you $500. You're going to get $500 from me for my kid, no matter what. I'm going to put. We're going to make this. This is not going to be a week to week deal. I'm going to give you a. We're going to have a 3 month period together. You know, because the coach doesn't want to lose the money. The
right.
Teacher doesn't want to lose the money, and they can all say that. You know, they all have that. And a lot of them have that in the back of their head. And then I think that the player, the child, needs to be in the middle of it too. The child needs to be in the middle of saying what they think they're getting and what they and how they want to improve. And the coach, the conversation should take place between all three of them. Rather than these separate parent-teacher conferences.
Right. I feel like a lot of times, you know, the kid gets complacent. And so then that leads to the coach getting complacent. And then the parent, looking in from the outside, says, hey, wait a minute. You know, we're devoting this time, this money, this making this commitment for our child to become a better tennis player.
Right.
And there's this complacency going on, and it's not okay. Like,
there's got to really start first with the player. Got to really start with a child, like complacency being what? Not playing as much, or not practicing as much, or not seeming as engaged?
All of the above.
Then the parent ought to have maybe the talk with the child and say, hey, what's going on? Are you liking tennis as much, or how much are you wanting to play, or is something about it boring to you, or is there something else in your life that's engaging you more? Let's figure this out. And it's really... Mm-hmm. Right, because the real center of it all is the player. I mean, because the way it gets to one of my other premises, which I've always said, which is that no one ever produced a player. Factories produce cars, but the only person who ever produced a tennis player was a tennis player.
Right.
No one produced a player. That's one of my premises.
And so these coaches who claim to
they don't produce players. The players produce the players. The coaches facilitate. No more mm-hmm. than. No more than my school teachers produced me. They didn't produce
right.
me. I made me.
Right.
I made me. You made you. Yeah, did they facilitate? Did they provide significant engagement? And golly, of course. Look, someone like Gloria Connors or Richard Williams or Jimmy Everts, they devoted significant hours, but the players are the ones who put in the work.
Right.
So that aspect, and when coaches talk about the players they produced, that's not what I care about. I want to care about how you can make me a better player, to recognize me as a human being, not your resume of trophies.
Hmm.
I don't really care about your resume of trophies. I care about how you can help me. How you can help me. Yeah, I acknowledge that. I acknowledge that that speaks to something that you've done. Good for you. But I want to know, good, now that we're aware of that, now that we have the, you know, equalized players who we produced or whatever, players who've come from your academy, how are you going to help my child become a better player? Paying money for private lessons and private coaching, how are you going to help my child become better based on what you know about my child? I mean, it's a very close kind of relationship. You know, it's not meant to be a factory.
Right. It's funny because I just had that conversation with one of the coaches where my son trains, and he said, you know, his initial relationship with my son was very confrontational. My son, you know, really just did not have the respect for this coach and really didn't appreciate this coach getting involved in his tennis because he wasn't my son's primary coach. And he said, it's funny, I've found now a way to get through to him. It took a while, but I finally feel like I have a connection with him and we're good, you know? And that made me, as a parent, I have to tell you, feel great that this coach was willing to step outside his comfort zone and put some thought into what it's going to take to engage this child who is, for whatever reason, putting up barriers. And, you know, why my son was doing that is a whole other set of issues. But the fact that the coach was willing to take those steps, to me, felt really good. You know, that's what I hope as a parent that my child's coaches and teachers are going to do. They're going to find a way to engage my child and connect with them. Not
well, if they don't, that if they can't do that, then they're not communicating, because coaching, it's coaching, which is teaching, and teaching is connecting, and connecting is communicating. And the thing I'd want, like I started taking lessons again this spring, and the thing I like about the person I'm taking lessons from is this person has a desire to understand me and a desire to engage with me in my tennis. And I find way too many tennis teachers I talk to, that's not really what they do. What they really do is transfer data, and they don't really engage with people as a human being. And they have, okay, here's the data I have, do apply the data I tell you. And that's not coaching, you know?
Right. You're absolutely right. Well, on that note, I'm going to bring our show to a close because we have run past our 60-minute mark, and I know your time is very valuable.
This is great. No, I could go on forever on this. This is fantastic.
Well, you're going to come on again because we're...
I will.
Ton of stuff we haven't touched on that I really want to get your thoughts on, and I just love chatting with you. You have so much experience and so much wisdom that you bring to the table, and I'm so grateful for that. So for those of you listening, thanks for tuning in today. I hope you'll share the podcast with your friends. The podcast link will be online at parentingaces.com on our radio show page later this afternoon. It's also always available through iTunes if you haven't subscribed to the Blog Talk Radio UR Tennis podcast on iTunes. Do that and you'll have access. And Joel, thank you so much for being with us, and I appreciate you more than you know, and look forward to our next opportunity to chat.
Thanks, Lisa. I enjoyed it. Take care.
Thank you. You too. Have a great week, everybody.
You